This is Second Look. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's news director. The General Assembly is now deep into its 2016 session, so to get you caught up, we're devoting a good chunk of today's show to some of the highlights on what lawmakers are doing from Virginia Public Radio. Those issues include juvenile justice, cops in classrooms, and concealed weapons. Also, we'll have a look at the Virginia Tech researcher leading the team that's testing the lead-poisoned water in Flint, Michigan. And stay tuned for this week's episodes of The Spark and Our Island Universe. First, Virginians are in strong favor of changes to the juvenile justice system. That's according to a new poll from Virginia Commonwealth University. As Virginia Public Radio's Mallory No Payne reports, it's a good thing because improving the system is on the agenda for lawmakers this legislative session.
84% of Virginians support changes to how the state deals with kids who have committed crimes. That's according to Robin McDougall, faculty director of VCU's Office of Public Policy Outreach.
There was strong support across all demographics, across all political parties, in this idea of doing something different with juveniles in Virginia than what we're currently doing.
Currently, the state puts kids in one of two large adult-style prisons near Richmond. Legislators are considering the governor's proposal to close those facilities and build two smaller ones instead, using the savings to support small community-based centers so kids can stay near home and family. According to the poll, more than 90% of Democrats and Republicans in the state support that kind of alternative. In Richmond, I'm Mallory No Payne.
And this related story, last spring, the Center for Public Integrity named Virginia as the state most likely to call the cops on kids at school. Now the Legal Aid Justice Center is calling on Virginia's legislature to do something about that, as Virginia Public Radio's Sandy Houseman reports.
Children in Virginia are three times more likely than kids in other states to be arrested at school, and the Legal Aid Justice Center says the odds are even higher in certain communities and for certain children.
There's massive racial disparities, and there's massive disparities with respect to students with disabilities.
That's attorney Jason Langberg. He says it's wrong to apply criminal terms to bad behavior by children.
Something as childish as running down a hallway or a quick pushing and shoving can be characterized as disorderly conduct, if not assault and battery. We've seen kids who have experienced very serious trauma who are aggressively grabbed from behind. And when they react in understandable, predictable ways, they're then charged with assault and battery or resisting. And that happens for kids as young as 10, 11, 12 years old.
He argues districts would be better off hiring psychologists and social workers who understand young people. The Legal Aid Justice Center is asking lawmakers in Richmond to develop statewide guidelines for calling in police, to require special training for those who are stationed in schools, and to clarify the role of cops in classrooms. I'm Sandy Houseman.
The drinking water expert from Virginia Tech who first uncovered the lead contamination in Flint, Michigan's water supply will lead ongoing testing of the water there. Virginia Public Radio's Robbie Harris has more.
Flint Mayor Karen Weaver has commissioned Mark Edwards, a professor of environmental engineering at Virginia Tech, to pick up where he left off and continue monitoring the water after he first detected the problem there last year.
It was the worst lead in water we have ever seen in 25 years, and I've seen a lot. A child drinking a single glass of that water could go from zero lead in their blood to eight times federal standards of lead poisoning.
Edwards will report directly to Mayor Weaver. She said the team's work will be funded by private donations. A report in the Washington Post this week said area residents there made signs and displayed them at what's become a kind of real-life message board. In big black capital letters, it said, quote, "You want our trust? We want Virginia Tech." Locals say they don't trust the firm the city had first said it would hire to do the water testing. I'm Robbie Harris.
Meanwhile, a Virginia legal battle about the use of bathrooms by transgender students had its day in federal court on Wednesday. A three-judge panel in Richmond found itself grappling with the very definition of gender, as Mallory No Payne reports.
At the heart of this case is a 16-year-old guy named Gavin Grimm.
So I can say I did not set out to make waves. I set out to use the bathroom. And it's scary. And it's not easy.
born biologically female, Grimm came out as a transgender male last year. The school board barred him from the boys' restroom, providing a unisex option instead. Judges now have to decide if Grimm has been treated unequally because of his gender. The school board defines gender anatomically, classifying Grimm as female. But Grimm's lawyer, Joshua Block, argues that sex is not just biology.
A person's sex is determined by more than just their chromosomes, and that, you know, your gender identity is a critical component of your sex, and that's, you know, what all the science says.
One judge, Paul Niemeyer, seemed to take a more conservative view. You're suggesting the school should make the sex determination on psychology, he said to Grimm's lawyer during oral arguments. What gives you the basis to make that interpretation? But another judge, Andre Davis, pushed back against the idea that gender is purely a matter of anatomy, suggesting society has moved on. He said, quote, "This is 2016, right?" A ruling in the case isn't expected for at least 2 months, but when it does come, it could have implications for public schools nationwide. In Richmond, I'm Mallory Nopain.
Opponents of new gun control laws have set their sights on two executive orders issued by the governor, vowing to undo Terry McAuliffe's limits on those who want to carry concealed weapons in the Commonwealth. Sandy Hausman has that story.
Letters have gone out to 25 states informing them that because they have different rules for carrying a concealed weapon, Virginia will no longer honor the permits they've issued. Senator Bill Carrico says that's a big problem for his district.
Being a legislator that represents an area that is bordered by Tennessee, North Carolina, West Virginia, and Kentucky, and a lot of times to get to a place in Southwest Virginia, you got to go through those states. In Bristol, you can stand on State Street and straddle the double solid line, and depending on which side your holster's on, you could be in violation of the law.
And Senator Tom Garrett argued people with permits to carry a concealed weapon are hardly the problem.
Concealed permit holders are responsible for 1/200th of crimes. The safest, most law-abiding segment of the entire population of the Commonwealth.
But Senator Dick Sasslaw pointed out that the governor was just enforcing a law that enjoyed bipartisan support when the legislature approved it.
I got news for you. Y'all voted for that law. Now, not you all, but the people who were here before you when we put that on the books. They voted for it. They had to have the same requirements we had.
And Sasslaw pointed out that some states that enjoy reciprocity with Virginia have done a poor job of screening those who got concealed carry permits.
Apparently, Florida, as of 2006, had already handed out 1,400 concealed weapons permits to citizens who had criminal records, 218 outstanding warrants, including 14 wanted for murder.
Lawmakers will also try to undo the governor's ban on guns in government buildings, an order that worries Carrico.
We here on the General Assembly grounds are afforded the protection from the Capitol Police. What about those at VDOT? What about those at DMV? What about the times that you drive down the interstate and you stop at the rest area? You're criminally violating a trespass law now that the executive order is in place.
But supporters of the gubernatorial ban cast doubt on the wisdom of letting people carry guns in any public place. Again, Dick Sasslaw.
If somebody comes in here and starts shooting and you take out your gun in the process of maybe even killing this guy, you injure four or five people. These lawyers have told me you better have one heck of an insurance policy because you're going to need it after you get finished getting sued. And if you kill somebody who was not the guy with the gun, you're going to be prosecuted with a minimum a manslaughter charge.
Opponents of the ban responded with several tales of gun owners who successfully defended themselves, including Carrico, who claimed he encountered a fight in the parking lot of a restaurant. When Carrico tried to intervene, he claims the man pointed a gun at him in his brand-new pickup truck, a gesture he said made him mad.
I hit the gentleman with my door, knocked him back, pulled my gun, and I was prepared to shoot. He saw the gun and began to flee.
Carrico says the culprit is now serving a 2-year sentence in prison. because Governor McAuliffe has said he will veto legislation that threatens public safety, opponents of his executive orders are not expected to succeed in overturning them. I'm Sandy Houseman.
I think roller derby is a hopeful thing.
He earned enough money from selling plants that he paid off the mortgage on his house.
People always want to know, is that a lie or is that the truth?
I completely disassembled this Triumph TR6.
I wish I could have been a professional woman soccer player.
I'm Martha Woodruff, and this is The Spark, an exploration of interesting people doing interesting things. Michael Signer is the brand new mayor of Charlottesville. He's also the author of Becoming Madison, the extraordinary origins of the least likely founding father. So I asked him during our telephone conversation, how's Mr. Jefferson's small city taking to having a Madison scholar for a mayor?
I think they're taking it well. I think that they're kind of getting a kick out of it. And there's been so much rethinking of kind of the constant idealization of Jefferson, bringing him back down to earth as a very flawed, still remarkable figure. They were all flawed. They all did terrible things as well as wonderful things. And I think it's an opportunity to put Madison back in the mix as someone who was really bringing reason and deliberation and thoughtfulness and conviction and conscience. I mean, the most important motif that's coming back in here is conscience, over and over and over again. And conscience being delivered not by somebody so charismatic and tall and graceful and imaginative and idealistic and sweeping and poetic as Jefferson. That was what Jefferson's role was in the country. Madison was a much different character, but the way that conscience was present in him and the way that he would pursue his causes created this magic and this almost magnetic pull around this little man in any public assembly. And I'm so interested in cracking the code of how he did that and how that was central to his forcefulness and his power and the way that he shaped not just a country, but I think democracy for the ages. So I'm very willing to bring that discussion to Charlottesville and the home of Jefferson. I'm cheerful about it, but I enjoy kind of having that debate.
It's Madison time. Hit it.
Just reading Michael Signer's resume is exhausting. Princeton undergrad, Berkeley poli-sci PhD, UVA law degree, experience teaching, working on political campaigns, running for lieutenant governor, writer of two scholarly books, etc., etc., etc. So I asked, Michael, where does all your drive slash curiosity come from?
My grandparents had been labor organizers when they were in New York City back in the early part of the century. My grandmother had been a secretary at the New School in New York City to Hannah Arendt, and she knew Hannah Arendt, and she spoke about her as a great woman. They sort of had been in sync with a lot of the great machinery of the 20th century, and I really remember talking and learning about that from them. My parents are both journalists, and they had been involved in political journalism. So my dad was at the Washington Post for a long time. So they bring a seriousness of thinking about how stories get told, about learning more about things, that there's a deeper truth, I guess, to current events. I remember when I first got to college, the political theory just bit me like a bug, and it never let go. And I always wanted to do and work on political theory, but I never really wanted to do it from within the academy. So I wanted to get a PhD, but I didn't think that I was going to be a professor, which is pretty unusual to do, especially when you go someplace like Berkeley. So I when I got there, I think I surprised some of my colleagues by attacking it with an intensity because I wanted to get through it. I had friends at Berkeley who had been there for 8 or 9 years, and I got through in under 4 years because I wanted to go to law school and because I wanted to get to work on bringing all this stuff into a life involved in service and in provoking discussion and debate about things. When I became a lawyer, I got really involved in voter protection and election work because that, to me, was key to the integrity of our democracy. I have been involved in a lot of national security work, even working at think tanks because they are a very powerful set of entities in our country and shaping how we think about public policy, and it's a good place where people who care about philosophy and ideas can work. It's shaped my the two books that I've written. One was about demagogues and democracy. The second, this book about Madison, is about statesmanship and democracy. Some of the work that I've wanted to do, I was counsel to Mark Warner when he was governor, and I really relished working for an executive and taking a part in how government was working from Richmond, kind of going out. And some of the work that I did, I worked on the restoration of rights petitions for ex-felons. I did National Guard and Reserve policy. Yeah, I just am kind of curious and amazed by all these. Any time I get the chance to be on site, whether I'm doing, whether I'm helping an idea become a reality in public life, it's just an amazing opportunity to me, and I'm constantly trying to learn. Being mayor of Charlottesville is this kind of adventure every day where people are beating us up a lot, but I'm meeting a ton of people. I think we're getting a lot done. I feel very excited about putting the drive that you mentioned, I guess, which I see as energy and curiosity, into practice. And I'm trying to do that on things as specific as figuring out how do we get this hulk of a blighted hotel that's been kind of moldering on our downtown mall for 4 years. How do we get that moving? And I'm doing that. We passed a resolution that included a reference to condemnation last week. These are very specific things, but that involved a lot of research and counsel. And this is my lesson from Madison. I mean, he was this great philosopher, but he was also involved with very practical, hundreds of very practical military and economic and infrastructure questions, and that was what he was proudest of.
When you look at where you are in your life, how are you doing?
I feel good, but I always feel a little restless about trying to make the most of one's potential in this challenging world that we have. I guess I've been very blessed/cursed with this excess of energy and interests, and I like that. I'm very curious. The thing that I think is so cool about failure, and I've had just dozens and dozens and dozens of failures. I had two failed book proposals before I got the first book. The second book, I think, is a lot better in some ways than the first book, and that's in part because I learned. So, you know, I ran for office and lost before I won. I had to learn a lot about the law before I could start my own practice. I've had it took me a long time to find the right woman to get married and to have kids, which I did when I was, you know, in my 40s. So I view the next stages are going to have to take advantage of the lessons I'm learning right now. But I really like that idea. So I see life as kind of a constant stair steps, I guess. And I have greater ambitions for what I'll do with writing, definitely. And I have, you know, I really like doing public service. I like it a lot. I don't know where that'll go, but I'm trying to do everything I can right now as mayor and throw myself into it full-heartedly. And people seem to really be liking that. I'm 3 weeks into the job. But I feel pretty good, but not finished, I guess, right now.
Michael Signer will be talking about his book, Becoming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father, this Tuesday at WMRA's Books and Brews. All details are at WMRA.org.
Hey, everybody, gather around, it's Madison time. The Madison, the Madison, the Madison.
I'm Chanel Barani, and this is Our Island Universe. Every year on February 2nd, Punxsutawney Phil comes out of his hole to see if he can see a shadow. Tradition says that if he does, then there will be 6 more weeks of winter. While this may be a day filled with fun, frivolity, and laughter, the origin of this festival really comes from the stars. Groundhog Day is known as a cross-quarter day, that date midway between a solstice and an equinox. This date is rooted in the Celtic tradition that says if a hibernating animal casts a shadow on February 2nd, the pagan holiday of Imbolc, winter will last another 6 weeks. February 2nd is also known as Candlemas Day, which is a Christian holiday. In the United Kingdom, an old sailor's rhyme says, "If Candlemas Day is clear and bright, winter will have another bite. If Candlemas Day brings cloud and rain, winter is gone and will not come again." Now, February 2nd is no longer the actual cross-quarter day because of the change from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. The actual midpoint date in 2016 would fall on February 5. Nevertheless, we know that whether the groundhog sees his shadow or not, our long winter suffering is halfway done and that spring is just 6 weeks away. I'm Chanel Varani, director of the John C. Wells Planetarium in Harrisonburg, Virginia.
This week on WMRA, we are going to kick off a month-long series for February on the refugee experience in Virginia. You may not know that the Harrisonburg and Charlottesville areas lead the way in Virginia in accepting people from around the world fleeing violence and war. Only the Northern Virginia area accepts more refugees. So, amid a fierce national debate over accepting new asylum seekers, especially from Syria, what is their experience like once they get here? Who is helping them adjust to their new lives here? And how many of them want to stay? We're going to kick off that series later this week during Morning Edition, so do be listening for that. Support for WMRA's News and Information Fund, which makes our award-winning coverage possible, is provided by Bibb and Dolly Frazier, Eugene Stoltzfus Architects, Joy Loving, Janet Trettner, the Just Pax Fund, an anonymous donor, and by a grant from a donor-advised fund of Harrisonburg and Rockingham County. We could use your help, too, to learn more about our News and Information Fund and how you can help. Go to WMRA.org, mouse over News, then click on News and Information Fund. I'm Bob Levicky, WMRA's News Director and Morning Edition host. I'll talk to you in the morning. Hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday.